From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
At long last, 11 weeks after the regular lawmaking session ended, Florida lawmakers have passed a state budget. Among the items that did not make it into the new spending plan, Florida Forever funding.
There seems to be this idea that it's a burden to the taxpayers.
Also this week, lawmakers will be back in Tallahassee next week for a special session to reduce property taxes, although some worry the impact on rural, poorer communities may be severe.
So you're going to knock off just the majority of the property taxes off their rolls and their ability to provide services.
We'll also hear from some frustrated Florida educators who are seeing public schools being hit on all sides by naysayers. And we'll head to Northwest Florida, where more than a few folks are upset about the possibility of a data center coming to their backyards. I'm Tom Flanagan, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Well, Florida lawmakers passed a state budget this afternoon. That followed an extended process that required a special session to complete the spending plan for the second year in a row. The House and Senate couldn't reach an agreement during the regular session that ended back in March. The spending plan for the fiscal year that starts July 1st will be nearly $115 billion. Budget highlights include money for education, the environment, and pay raises for some state workers. Senate Appropriations Chair Ed Hooper says the final budget is fiscally sound.
Our revenue forecasts have stabilized, so by spending less than we have, we continue to right-size our budget for the long term.
House Minority Leader Fentress Driscoll says the final budget does not meet the needs of many Floridians.
Floridians are in a real crunch when it comes to rising costs, and that to me is why this budget is inadequate. It seemed to me that we should have focused more on delivering affordability for Floridians.
Governor Ron DeSantis will have about 1 month to sign the budget and issue vetoes before the July 1st start of the fiscal year. Florida's main conservation land buying program gets no new money from the state next year. Instead, WUSF Steve Newborn reports state lawmakers are paying ranchers and farmers not to develop their lands.
The state Senate allocated $35 million to Florida Forever earlier this year, and Governor Ron DeSantis had proposed spending more than three times that much. But the budget state lawmakers proposed this week zeros out any new funding. Gil Smart with Friends of the Everglades is not happy about it.
There seems to be this idea that it's a burden to the taxpayers, that acquiring land requires the actual purchase price and requires the upkeep of it. For whatever reason, the appetite for actually acquiring these environmentally sensitive lands seems to be diminishing.
Instead, lawmakers proposed more than $400 million to pay for conservation easements that prevent agricultural lands from being developed. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
Florida's legislature is having another special session next week. This time, lawmakers want to put an item on the ballot this November that would reduce property taxes. Tristan Wood reports the proposal from Governor Ron DeSantis will lead to an initial increase in homestead exemptions and scale up to eventually eliminate all taxes on homesteaded properties.
The governor's plan would immediately raise the homestead property tax exemption from $50,000 to $250,000. He says that deal will eliminate property taxes for 60% of Florida homeowners and reduce them drastically for others. To be eligible, homeowners must maintain Florida residency for 5 years.
Someone has a $200 million home, what, they're going to get this massive? I'd rather focus on folks who are new homeowners, young people, seniors on fixed income, you know, our middle-class folks, and so this will be really significant.
Local governments have raised concerns about what the lost revenue could mean for the services they provide. Craigan Mosteller with the Florida Association of Counties says it will cost counties $5.6 billion in revenue. That's not counting losses to cities or school systems.
It's just a major restructuring of government in the state of Florida, and not in a good way, not in a way that's sustainable or something that's going to allow us to continue to build communities that people want to live in.
DeSantis has pushed back against those claims from local governments. He says local governments would be required to use property tax revenue to fund essential services under his proposal, and it includes a state trust fund to provide grants to local governments for essential services.
That revenue can only be used for schools, for police, for fire, and the core services that we all agree on. It's not going to be allowed to be used on some of the other things that I know are a little bit more divisive in terms of whether they're going to do.
Mosteller says that grant program likely won't be enough. She says smaller, more rural counties will be hit the hardest.
If you look at Wakulla County, Gadsden County, just in the surrounding area, the impacts there are significant because not only are the majority of those homes homesteaded, but they're lower valued homes too. So you're going to knock off just the majority of the property taxes off their rolls and their ability to provide services.
Democrats are opposing the cuts. Florida House Democratic Leader Fentress Driscoll is concerned the plan will make local governments unstable.
When we have folks who are trying to make decisions between whether to pay rent or to buy groceries, I think it is a gross misstep of this governor and the Republicans in the legislature to move to eliminate property taxes when people might need to rely on their local governments for more services at a time of national instability. And believe me, again, I am all for affordability solutions, but there are ways to do this that don't involve hobbling our local governments.
But since Democrats are a super minority party in the legislature, their opposition won't be enough to stop the issue from reaching the ballot. Florida Senate President Ben Allbritton has signaled support for the proposal. House Speaker Daniel Perez has stated his chamber needs more time to review the idea, but has generally supported property tax changes. But DeSantis and lawmakers cannot approve the proposal alone. Florida voters will have a say in November. For the measure to pass, it needs to get at least 60% support. The governor says he's confident his proposal will cross the finish line.
But I think you're going to have a lot of voters who say, okay, they want this, they think it'll be good, they just want to make sure that it's doable. So the fact that we're doing the phase-in, the fact that we have this fund, the fact that we're limiting the remaining property tax to the core services, I think it answers those concerns.
Lawmakers will convene starting Monday. I'm Tristan Wood.
Coming up on Capitol Report, congressional candidates are weighing in as a potential data center project could be heading to North Florida's Jackson County.
I'm not a fan of these AI data centers or the risks they pose to our critical drinking water.
Florida public school educators are feeling a bit under attack nowadays.
That we're indoctrinating kids, that we're grooming kids, we're turning girls into boys and boys into girls, and who's going in what locker room is just a bunch of crap.
Those adversely impacted by alligator Alcatraz are patiently waiting for the facility to breathe its last.
We can't even go down that road anymore to do what we do on a cultural aspect to honor, you know, our loved ones that have transitioned on.
And some young reporters are jumping in to fill the news gap left in places no longer served by professional journalists. A discussion surrounding a potential AI data center drew congressional candidates to North Florida's Jackson County recently. Randy Buxta with WFSU's Rural News Service reports the conversation is happening at the same time a state law to regulate such centers is set to go into effect this July.
Jackson County residents are overflowing the local commission chambers. Out in the street, they're holding signs reading, "Don't ruin our aquifer," and "We can't drink data." Back inside, Zachary Luttrell is speaking to the commission.
When did morals and empathy get tossed out the window for money?
Luttrell thinks data centers are moving into communities without paying attention to the impact they could have. He's worried about what the heavy water use that often goes along with data centers could mean for a nearby lake where his family likes to spend their weekends.
That sucks to tell my kids that because of a data center, family fun days at Ink and Find may no longer be a thing.
Large load data centers that help to power artificial intelligence programs have begun to spring up across the country, bringing concerns about noise pollution, higher electricity costs, and water use. Residents in Jackson County worry those problems have now reached their doorstep, and it's caught the attention of political candidates.
I'm not a fan of these AI data centers or the risks they pose to our critical drinking water.
Keith Gross is a Republican candidate running to represent Florida's 2nd Congressional District. Members of his team attended the recent Jackson County meeting. Later, in a phone call, Gross said he doesn't like the idea of a data center anywhere in North Florida. His concerns on the issue cross party lines. Yen Bailey, a Democrat running for the same congressional seat, was also at the meeting.
Even the thought of a data center coming into this community at this time is irresponsible, you know, with our water levels being what they are. But even if we were not in a drought situation, these data centers don't bring, you know, any benefit that they bring to this community are far outweighed by the harms that come along with it.
Another congressional candidate at the meeting, Democrat Nick Zeteslo, raised concerns about public disclosure. He says not enough is known about the project.
No developers have been named, no end user has been named. You don't know who you're negotiating with, and that alone should stop this process dead in its tracks.
Jackson County officials say their planning department received documents relating to a solar farm or battery storage facility, but after review began to believe the project may actually be a large-scale data center based on what's happened with similar projects in other states. That's one reason Commissioner Paul Donofrio Jr. says he'd like to take more time before making a decision.
But if there is one proposed, it gives us the opportunity to do our due diligence, do our research to find out whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Right now, based on everything that I am seeing, more than likely would be a bad thing.
Another reason Donofrio Jr. says it makes sense to put the discussion on hold, a new law is scheduled to go into effect in July. It puts rules in place that ensure companies behind the centers, not local residents, pay for any added energy infrastructure needed for the centers to operate. It also puts water use protections in place and gives local governments control over where the centers can be built. Jackson County commissioners voted unanimously to put a one-year moratorium on any data center discussion. Their hope is that will give them more time to understand more about the company's plan, study its potential environmental and economic impacts, and give the new state law time to go into effect. I'm Randy Vuxta.
Fewer students, decreased funding, attacks from hostile politicians and partisan media. It seems public schools, especially in Florida, are going through tough times. According to former teacher, school superintendent, county commissioner, state lawmaker, and now head of the Florida School Superintendents Association, Bill Monford, the big bugaboo is inflation's impact on school funding.
And even though each year there's what's called a record amount of funding for public education, and that's true, but I think if you compare the numbers, just real simply put, the cost of living and the expenses has gone up. Those costs have gone up higher than the increase in support in public education. It's just a simple matter of math.
But what the state of Florida giveth, it can also taketh away. Monford notes districts get fewer dollars when they enroll fewer students.
If you drop in enrollment, of course, you drop in fundings. But in many cases, your expenses will remain the same.
He cites the ongoing need to maintain schools, run buses, staff classrooms, and all the other costs associated with education. And why are there fewer kids going to public schools?
There are a lot more parents who are taking a different approach to educating their children, either homeschool or private school. And then you've got the scholarships. In 2023, the legislature removed all caps in terms of income, so anybody can qualify for a scholarship. And we have more parents who are taking those options.
Although Monford insists the state's public schools can successfully compete with even the best private, charter, and home schools, the student drain continues. Leon County School Superintendent Rocky Hanna lays much of the blame on state and national politicians and their media allies.
Elected officials at the highest of levels talk negatively about public schools and public school teachers and what's going on in our classrooms, that we're indoctrinating kids, that we're grooming kids, we're turning girls into boys and boys into girls, and who's going in what locker room is just a bunch of crap.
And since fewer students means less funding, more and more Florida school districts are having to consolidate and close schools. Orange County is shutting down 6 elementary and 1 middle school. Broward County is shuttering 4 elementary, 1 middle, and 1 high school. 9 schools are closing in Miami-Dade. Even tiny Union County in northeast Florida is facing the possibility of school closures. Caught in the middle, it seems, are Florida teachers. Here's Jonah Mundy, a science teacher at Tallahassee's NIMS Middle School.
Florida currently is ranked 50th in the nation in terms of teacher salary. And that's causing talented teachers, talented professionals, young teachers, veteran teachers to leave the profession. Not because we want to, because we simply can't afford it.
Leon Superintendent Rocky Hanna notes there are fewer and fewer education majors coming out of the state's colleges and universities. He thinks there are two major reasons.
One is the pay, is certainly the pay. And two is this horse crap about what's going on in public schools. Okay, and all the culture wars and all the other things that are being said. And young people are going, I'm not getting in the middle of that for $48,000, right? I mean, who would want that job?
Still, if little can be done at the local level to tamp down the negative rants against public schools, maybe something can be done to bring in more money. The Leon School District plans to ask the county's voters for a $1 million boost in property taxes. And school board member Roseanne Wood notes nearly half of the state's other districts are doing the same.
There are four millage increase, 29 counties in Florida that have made that decision. They realize that we are not being funded adequately from the state, and so they are taking it into their own hands.
The tax increases will be decided by Florida voters in the November election. We have an update on the future of Florida's alligator Alcatraz in the Everglades. For more than 40 weeks, volunteers from Southwest Florida have gathered every Sunday outside the immigrant detention center known as Alligator Alcatraz. They pray for the people detained inside and for the facility itself to close down. Now, with reports that the Department of Homeland Security may shut the detention center down by early June because of mounting costs, the weekly vigils show no signs of stopping. WLRN's Joshua Ceballos was at Alligator Alcatraz recently and brings us this story.
We will return.
We will return.
Shut it down.
Shut it down.
On a recent Sunday afternoon, more than two dozen people gathered around a patch of dirt across the street from Alligator Alcatraz. Many of them are in their 60s and older. Retirees and snowbirds from Naples and Fort Myers on Florida's west coast who either take a tour bus or drive an hour and a half or more to be here every week. They've come from various churches and faith traditions to pray and to demonstrate against the reportedly inhumane conditions inside the detention center, where detainees have claimed that people are kept in cages with limited access to medical care and basic hygiene.
It just sickened me that this is a country that shouldn't be standard for anything like this.
That's 82-year-old John Reynolds from Naples, talking from his seat on a blue lawn chair that he brought on the bus from home. He's a retired Army veteran who started coming to the vigils after hearing that Florida and Alligator Alcatraz were becoming models for immigrant detention facilities around the country.
This isn't what it should be. This isn't what it, a lot of people in the service spent their time, you know, paying a price for.
The folks here have forged a community through the vigil, connecting with each other to plan demonstrations and garner support for people in detention and their families. One person brings fruits from their yard or brownies that their wife made. People share tents and signs that they brought from home. They share in joy as well as in grief. Ariane Betancourt's father, Justo, was recently released from detention at Alligator Alcatraz. She'd been a regular attendee at the Sunday Freedom Vigils, but couldn't make it this time. She called, and an organizer put a mic up to the telephone.
First of all, I wish I was there today to celebrate with all of you that my dad is finally free. He is home. I want to thank everyone for 42 weeks of efforts, not just for my families, but for so many others.
Betancourt couldn't be at the vigil in person because her dad was in the hospital.
My father was released in the worst health condition that I've ever seen. He can barely speak. He can barely walk. He was experiencing strokes inside of during detention, and they were doing nothing about it. They would tell him to drink water, lay down, and sleep it off.
A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security confirmed that Justo was arrested last October and described him as a, quote, criminal illegal alien from Cuba. The spokesperson said there is no record of Justo suffering a stroke while in detention and that ICE provides comprehensive medical care, quote, from the moment an alien enters ICE custody. Vigil members prayed for the Betancourt family, just as they prayed for Justo for the many months that he was in detention. Even members of the Miccosukee Native American tribe joined in, including local activist and tribal member Betty Osceola.
And Creator, I ask for your prayers and your help for the young lady who has been coming here, for her father who had been in here for 6 months. I pray that for the healing for this man and for his family so that he can spend more days with his family creating more happy memories.
The Miccosukee tribe has actively opposed Alligator Alcatraz because it sits in the middle of their ancestral land in the Everglades. The tribe joined a lawsuit led by nonprofit environmentalist group Friends of the Everglades to halt operations at the detention center on ecological grounds. Osceola told WLRN outside a federal courthouse in Miami several months ago that the facility is interrupting the tribe's cultural practices.
When there's times of loss in our community, we can't even go down that road anymore to do what we do on a cultural aspect to honor, you know, our loved ones that have transitioned on. So we're being put in a situation to have to look elsewhere to do that.
Noelle D'Amico is Director of Social Justice for the Worker Circle, a national secular Jewish organization that works in social activism. They're also the organizing entity behind Freedom Vigils.
We give people a lot of support. We reach out to them. We say, you know, what is it that you're trying to build here? Where would be a good location? Have you looked at, is there a public, you know, sidewalk outside the ice court? You know, whatever you need to figure out, right? There's all sorts of stuff, right? And a lot of people, they want to do it, but they get nervous because they say, oh, I've never done anything like this. And we say, don't worry about that. We'll help you.
The group is sharing its strategic model for these vigils. They recently held a national Zoom call on a Monday night with demonstrators all over the country looking to pray and gather outside the detention centers in their communities.
I know that we have people from all across the country joining us this evening, Greenwood, Indiana, Phoenix, Arizona, LA. Oh, wow, already across the map, San Antonio, Texas.
The expansion of the Freedom Vigil is emblematic of one of the main messages running through the most recent gathering outside Alligator Alcatraz. The fight is not yet over.
You have done this, and we cannot give one inch. This is it.
That's right.
One yard line. And what happens at the 1 yard line? Anybody who's a football fan knows the defense gets stronger, man. Mm-hmm.
The New York Times recently reported that the Department of Homeland Security wants to close the facility because it's too costly to maintain. Vendors have allegedly been told to wind up operations by early June, near the first anniversary of the detention center's opening. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said at a recent press conference that the facility was never meant to stay open permanently.
It's at an airport down there where everything that we constructed is temporary. We didn't build any permanent facilities down there because we knew it was going to be temporary.
That clip is from WESH News in Orlando.
I'm not really sure. I believe it yet.
Nora Espinal has been to nearly every vigil since the beginning.
I mean, I believe it's going to happen because I believe there's $1 million a day. How much money do we have for hurricanes, tariff, hurricane season's right here? It has to close financially. I don't think we can afford it anymore. I don't think we could have ever afforded it.
While the news of the closure would seem to be a victory for the prayer group, they all share a sense that the real finish line is far ahead. Not just seeing Alligator Alcatraz shut down, but seeing accountability for the alleged abuses inside the facility against migrants trying to make a life in the U.S. I'm Joshua Ceballos in Miami.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a Palm Beach County program enlists high schoolers to fill local news gaps. Today, millions of Americans live in counties with no or limited access to local news. Startup news outlets are trying to fill the void in their communities. WLRN's Jake Shore reports on a Palm Beach County outlet's pilot program with reporters in high school.
Kelvin Verhovliak is a junior at Inlet Grove Community High School in Riviera Beach. He says he never really thought about journalism before.
Journalism wasn't really on my mind. I mean, I've seen journalism. It was like, yeah, journalism. Once you get into journalism, it's like, oh, wow, it's journalism. Like.
But now, he's one of five student reporters in STET News' Community Voices program. STET is a three-year-old digital outlet covering Palm Beach County, and its program is modeled after a Chicago initiative that pays adult residents to report on local government meetings. But Stet's version trains high schoolers on civics and journalism while paying them $200 a month to cover their hometown of Riviera Beach. Launched last April, the program has produced stories on a new bus program, a costly water treatment plant, and the appointment process for city advisory boards. 16-year-old Michaela Graham says she's learned the importance of sticking to the facts.
I realize it's kind of hard to like not include your opinion on certain things, but I feel like now that I'm doing it, like, I don't know, it's very impactful, I can say.
Riviera Beach is a majority black city north of West Palm Beach. Quality news coverage has largely disappeared as the local newspaper has receded. Census data says roughly 1 in 5 residents live in poverty, and developers are increasingly looking to the city as Palm Beach County's growth has exploded in the past decade. 17-year-old Miles Wiggum says he's learning things about his city he would have never known before.
Maybe 5 minutes from my house, they're tearing down this old, what was it called? The water park. It's the Riviera Water Park, and they're putting a new police station there. And I used to swim there as a kid. I wouldn't have known that it was getting tore down if I didn't go to these meetings.
The key part of the program is attending city government meetings and writing about them. It's a rite of passage for most Cub reporters.
I think I know what the angles are for that story. Why don't you tell me what you want to write about?
That's Liz Capozzi. She's one of Stet's co-founders and edits for the students. It's a weekday after school, and the journalists are crafting a story about how Riviera Beach was a finalist for something called the All-American City Awards. Michaela says she wrote
a very, very rough draft of it. I gave a little background on what the All-American Awards was, and I also talk about what Riviera Beach put in their application when they applied to it.
Over the next half hour, the students try to whittle down their different versions into a single story. They argue over descriptions, fact-check each other, and make sure the names are spelled correctly. CB Hanif is Inlet Grove's journalism teacher and shares nuggets of wisdom like this.
Editorial writing is the art of knowing what to leave out. Because you got all this stuff, and you're trying to distill it into a comment to tell readers, you know, what it means, why it's important, what should happen.
The group eventually gets the story into shape. And about a week later, I came back to Inlet Grove to interview them. I asked the students what they thought the future of journalism was. Here's Kelvin.
I feel like journalism is more through social media. Like, it's not even through articles or, for example, the New York Times. Back then, it was like major. Like, everybody wanted to read it. And I was like, the New York Times, like, it's like a little ancient thing. It's like a little, like in a museum, you can just post it up in the museum, you know. And so it's kind of interesting.
Miles takes the mic.
I just think a lot of people nowadays have issues reading things. So that's why they don't go to actual news sites anymore. I feel like they'd probably be interested in learning about the news, just we have to advertise it in a way that makes it easy for them to digest.
Michaela says she's gotten a lot out of the program. The
journalism as a whole opens the doors to like a lot of opportunities for us. Because I know that once I got into Stet News, I've been having so much opportunities to like, I guess, get my name out there.
While student reporters can't replace the media ecosystem we once had, it seems like a good place to start. I'm Jake Shore in Riviera Beach.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Steve Newborn, Joshua Ceballos, and Jake Shore. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.